the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Let's read then, shall we, from the book of Joshua. If you get the green Bible from the rack in front of you, you'll find that the book of Joshua is the sixth one in the Old Testament, from reading from the start of the Bible, and it begins on page 206. So, what we're doing in this series is picking out some of the key passages in the morning and speaking about those, looking at them in depth. But in the three evenings, we're going to go through the three major divisions of this book and try to give people a feel for the whole thing and how the whole thing fits together. That means we've got quite a bit we could read tonight, and maybe the best way of doing it would just be to read through chapters 1 to 5, but we won't do that. We'll read bits, and then I'll say one or two little bits about them. So, let's read from Joshua chapter 1. This is what Ruth spoke about this morning, but in case you weren't there, let's just have a look at what that chapter says, and then read on into 2, 3, 4, and 5. So, chapter 1 and verse 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the river Jordan into the land I am about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Verse 7. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it, and then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Well, let's look at chapter 2. Verse 1, then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. The king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy at the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab. Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they've come to spy out the whole land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. She said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they'd come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Verse 8. Before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you. Verse 11, when we heard of it, our hearts sank and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you'll spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. Well, in chapter 3, eventually, they get moving. And chapter 3 and verse 5 is the verse that I think probably sums up what we're talking about tonight more than anything else. Joshua told the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on ahead of the people. So they took it up and went ahead of them. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river. Now this is a time of year when the Jordan is always in flood. We find out that later in the chapter. Joshua said to the Israelites, verse 9, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you'll know that the living God is among you, and that he'll certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. And that's exactly what happened. Verse 15, now the Jordan is in flood all during harvest. Yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarathan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of Araba, that is the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So in chapter 4, there's something to do while the water is stopped in that way. And in chapter 4, verse 4, Joshua called together the 12 men he'd appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. Verse 10, now the priests who carried the ark remained standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything the Lord had commanded Joshua was done by the people, just as Moses had directed Joshua. The people hurried over, and as soon as all of them had crossed, the ark of the Lord and the priests came to the other side while the people watched. The men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over, ready for battle, in front of the Israelites, as Moses had directed them. About 40,000 armed for battle crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho for war. In verse 18, the priests came up out of the river, carrying the ark of the covenant of the Lord. And no sooner had they set their feet on the dry ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran in flood as before. Well, in chapter 5, finally, in the end of this section, there are three things to notice. To start with, at the beginning of chapter 5, when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and all the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites until they had crossed over, their hearts melted in fear, and they no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the Israelites again. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the Israelites at Gibeath Haraloth. Now this is why he did so. All those who came out of Egypt, all the men of military age, died in the wilderness on the way after leaving Egypt. All the people that came out had been circumcised, but all the people born in the wilderness during the journey from Egypt had not. Verse 9, then the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Verse 10, on the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. The day after the Passover, that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. The manna stopped the day after they ate this food from the land. There was no longer any manna for the Israelites, but that year they ate of the produce of Canaan. And the third thing in the chapter follows in the next couple of verses. Now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, are you for us or for our enemies? Neither, he replied. But as commander of the army of the Lord I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? The commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy. And Joshua did so. Well, that's an interesting tour around. I'm not sure what we're going to do in 2 weeks' time when we've got 12 chapters to cover, but that gives us a bit of the flavour of the start of the book anyhow, does it? Can we have the PowerPoint on? Is it working? No? Let me try and fiddle with something down here. That's there. Good. Fine. Excellent. That's great. Lovely. So, we've called this one Starting Out, and you'll see why in just a moment. The book of Joshua. Who wrote this book? Where does all this stuff come from? There are basically, I suppose, three main theories that people have about it. The first one you find way back in the old Jewish scriptures, the Babylonian Talmud, where it's claimed that Joshua actually wrote the book. That's very, very unlikely. And in fact, although it's a long-standing Jewish tradition, the Babylonian Talmud was no wiser than you or me, really, because it comes from the 3rd to 5th centuries AD, and so it's several hundred years after Joshua, to put it mildly. And so even in the days of John Calvin, it was pretty obvious that this was a non-starter, and Calvin in his commentary had very little time for the theory. The second theory, I suppose, is the one that most liberal scholars have nowadays, which is the idea that Joshua is just a collection from many different sources, all jumbled together, and it's a biased book as well. It's giving us history very much through a filter, presenting the things that the author wants us to have, or the authors want us to have, and not being fair to what was really going on in the situation at all. They claim that Joshua was just a very insignificant tribal chieftain, that there was no great capture of the land by the Israelites. But in fact, all that they did was to come in and kind of infiltrate bit by bit over the centuries, settle down and intermarry. And the whole idea of a Jewish takeover of land just isn't borne out by history or by archaeology. If, for instance, you look at the commentary on Joshua, which was written just a couple of years ago by the head of the Old Testament department at Manchester University, he says this: "We can conclude that the book of Joshua was not the product of a single person at a single time. It contains a variety of types of material, and as has been noted, there are inconsistencies, duplications, difficulties in presentation, and perhaps also developments in theological emphasis." In other words, it's been touched up a bit by later writers who have certain axes they want to grind, things they want to say, emphases they want to get across. And you can see the traces of that because the story doesn't hang together. There are all sorts of inconsistencies and contradictions. I'm not sure he's right about that because he doesn't actually produce many of them, and most of the ones he does, I think you can find good reasons for. He also says this: "It seems likely that some of the lists of cities and boundaries would have been taken from administrative records, but some of the material incorporated into the book was probably derived from oral traditions, memories from the past, and perhaps even hopes for the future." So he says, you can't make sense of it, really. It's a jumble of all sorts of stuff. And it's interesting, as a record of the Israelites' hopes and aspirations, as a record of history, it's totally worthless. Well, it's got to be said that there are difficulties with the history of this period. When we've looked at ancient cities like Jericho and Ai, which are mentioned in the story, which the Israelites are supposed to have conquered, we have found evidence that walls have fallen down, cities have been stormed, civilizations have disappeared. That's certainly true. But it's also the case that that's happened at times when it's not supposed to have happened. And at the times when, according to the chronology that we've always accepted for these things, the Israelites were there, it's pretty clear that they weren't. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, it seems to me, that the Bible is a load of rubbish. After all, Joshua gives you no dates whatsoever. And the Jewish chronology of these things and the Christian chronology of these things have always been at least 1,000 years apart from one another, if not 2,000. And so there's great uncertainty about when exactly these events took place. But it does seem to me that the story is consistent. It does make a certain amount of sense, and there aren't contradictions on every page. In fact, there are details that you wouldn't expect in something that was just a fairy tale account. Careful listing of dates and times and places, which makes it sound much more like somebody's trying to write history than that somebody's just making up myth as you go along. So there's a third point of view, and this is the one that I suppose most conservatives would go for these days, which is that it was written something like 2 centuries later. It wasn't written by Joshua, it wasn't contemporary, but it was still written within some kind of memory of the events that took place. So it couldn't just be a total fabrication in the way that many liberal scholars claim, because it does come from a period when people would still have fairly fresh memories handed down to them of what exactly had taken place. Well, you pay your money and you take your choice, but the way it seems to work out in terms of Bible history is this. If you look back at the 1200s BC, that's when you find Moses, the Exodus, and Joshua happening, probably. As I say, there are difficulties in working it out exactly, but that's probably when it happened. In the 1100s, you find the Judges coming along. That's the next book in the Old Testament. In the thousands, the 1000s, you get Saul and David and the start of the kingship, and then everything that happens from there. Solomon, 100 years later, 100 years after that, the great prophets Elijah and Elisha. In the 700s, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah 2, and the fall of the northern kingdom, which have split in the days of Solomon. Jeremiah comes in the 600s, and Babylon rises as a world power then. And in the 500s, you have the exile of the Israelites and their return to their own land. This is all roughly the way it is. Where does Joshua fit into this? Well, round about here. 200 years or so after the events took place, in the reign of Saul or David, when the country had a king for the first time, and it was in need of remembering its history, writing down what had happened, how God had got it up to this point. And so that seems to be the point at which the book of Joshua came to be written. How does Joshua fit in with the other books around it in the Old Testament? Well, if you look at the Old Testament we have nowadays, you find there are two histories of what happened to the Israelites, one after another. The first history runs through from Genesis, come on, that's it, thank you very much, from Genesis, it's fading in too slowly, right through to Kings. And you've got the five books of the law, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, and then some books that fill in the history after that point, Joshua, right up to 2 Kings, and those books give you the history of the kingdom as it goes in the promised land, right through to the point when the Israelites are taken away into exile. Then it starts again with Chronicles, and from Chronicles through to the end of Esther, you get a slightly different take on the history. And this time it goes on beyond the exile and takes you on into what happened when the Israelites were in Babylon, and indeed what happened when they came back from there. So Joshua's obviously in that first span of history, and it fits in two ways, it seems to me. For one thing, it's a completion of the five books of the law, those first five books of the Old Testament. Were leading somewhere. They were talking about promises that God had given to his people, an adventure they had to go on with him, for which God would give them the strength and the power that they needed. And without Joshua, the first five books aren't complete. That's why some people have in the past talked about the Hexateuch instead of the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch means the five books, Genesis through to Deuteronomy. And some people say, well, it should really be a Hexateuch, right? And that means the six books, which would include Joshua. But the Jewish nation never looked on Joshua in that way. To them, the first five were completely different. So Joshua also belongs somewhere else. It belongs with the whole tradition that comes after the book of Deuteronomy and the way that it spins out in history. So Joshua's kind of a turning point between the books of the law, God and Moses bringing the people to the promised land, and then the history of Israel from that point onwards. It belongs in both categories. That's where the book of Joshua fits in. Okay, so what's in it? Well, the book of Joshua pretty clearly divides down into two. The first bit that we're looking at now is all about the battles that the Israelites had to take over the promised land. And that's usually the exciting bit, the colourful bit that people talk about in Sunday school. All the stories are told from there. And then the second bit of the book is not quite so exciting, because it's about how the land was divided and the various tribes settled down. Which, I guess, if you came from the tribe of Naphtali or Asher or Gad or one of those, was dead exciting, because you got to know exactly where the boundaries of your traditional territory were supposed to be, and you could get very proud about it. But for people who have got no Jewish ancestry, it's a little bit boring, to put it mildly. So we've got those two parts to the book, but we're actually dealing with it in three parts, because it seems to me that first bit divides into two as well. There's a bit that we're surveying tonight, which we've called getting ready. There's a second bit, or no, we haven't called it that. That's what it's about, getting ready for the conflict. The actual fighting starts in chapter 6 and goes on through to chapter 12. So in terms of the three divisions that we've got for the book, we think the first bit is about starting out, the second bit is about winning through, and the third bit is about settling down. Now, the reason we've used those names is because we don't think the book of Joshua is simply a history book. We believe very strongly that it has things to teach us now, that it hasn't been preserved in the Bible just as an accident, but that it has principles and lessons running through it, which we can take and apply to our lives nowadays, both as individuals and as a church. And as this church starts out again on a new adventure with God this autumn, another year of service to him, we need to get hold of those principles and remember them, because they're pretty key. So tonight, we're just in the remaining time I've got, don't worry, it's only 7 or 8 minutes, we're going to have a look at this first section, starting out. Five chapters. What's in them? Well, we've had a look, haven't we? The first chapter is where God gives the command to Joshua about what he's to do. Okay, Moses has led you right up to the frontier of the promised land. One tiny detail is that there's a massive flowing river in between you and it, but don't worry about that. You are going to go across there, and you are going to conquer this land. And God, as we saw in the reading, gives Joshua his command to be strong and very courageous. Don't worry, I have commanded you. I'll be with you. You'll be able to do it, not in your own strength because you're not strong enough, but because I'm there with you. The second chapter is when he sends out the spies. And the spies go to the house of Rahab, at the prostitute in the city of Jericho. And there, they find to their astonishment that rather than the whole country being 100% united against the Israelites, there are cracks in their morale. There are people, there are families who are convinced that the Israelites have come with the power of God and they don't stand a chance. And so God encourages his people through what happens there. Chapter 3 is about crossing the Jordan and the way in which through that miracle God makes the river dry so that people can walk across. What happened? Was it that a wall of water suddenly stopped? Or was it, as some people say, oh well, you know, the Jordan can sometimes be blocked, stones fall into it, and sometimes the river is dry several miles up, and then you can walk across it on dry land. Well, that's possible. The one thing you have to say against that, of course, is that, as the book points out, this was the time when the rivers constantly flooded, so it would be very unusual for that to happen. Also, the chapter helpfully tells you where the blockage took place, and it's several miles upstream from where the Israelites were. So if it just happened by a natural accident that rocks fell into the river or something like that and blocked the path of the Israelites, it's absolutely amazing as a miracle of timing that the water stopped flowing just at the point where they wanted it to flow when they needed it, because a blockage must have happened several hours earlier. So whether it's a miracle of nature or a miracle of timing, the one thing the book of Joshua is sure about is it's a miracle. It's something that God did, and otherwise they'd never have got across the Jordan. So that was chapter 3. Chapter 4 is about the 12 stones. Before the Jordan is allowed to close up again, Joshua sends 12 hefty people in there and says, take some stones out of there, one for each of the tribes of Israel. Nobody's going to be missing. Everybody's going to be represented by one stone or another. And those will be a memorial to you that everybody got through, that God brought everybody across the Jordan, not just a few, not just one or two fortunate survivors, but the entire nation, because God cares about every single one of you, and you all came through the Jordan. And then the final thing, the fifth thing, is the chapter 5, the story of the Israelites being circumcised for the first time in a generation, and then the other things that happened. The manna stopped overnight, and Joshua had that strange encounter with somebody who claimed to be the captain of the Lord's army. Well, what does all of this say to us? I think there are different principles coming through these chapters, and they're all really about what God gives you when you start out with him. When you're prepared to put your faith to the test and go into an adventure with God, the first thing it seems to me that he gives you is a vision. You know that God has sent you. You know where you're going. You may be scared stiff, but you realize he is with you. That's why Joshua chapter 1 down through the centuries has meant a lot to Christians who've been in desperate situations, Christians who've not known how they're going to cope with the future. Don't be afraid. Have not I commanded you? I'm with you. Only be strong and of a good courage. Just carry on. Do what you know to be right, and I'll be with you all the way through. Time and again, those words have brought inspiration and courage into the lives of Christians who've been saying, Lord, this is too big. I know where you're sending me, but I know too that I can't make it. I know I don't have the power to handle it. I know I don't have the resources in myself. Lord, this is impossible. And Joshua chapter 1 has kicked in, and they've begun to realize that if God is with you, it doesn't matter who's against you, you're going to win. So that's the first thing I think that God does. But then chapter 2 talks about something else that happens to us when we start out with him. We get encouragements. Little things happen that show us that he's with us. You find this all over the Bible, don't you? Do you remember when Gideon is about to take on the Midianites in the book of Judges? He goes for a stroll near the Midianite camp just to see what's happening down there, see if there are any weak points in their defenses. And to his amazement, he hears a couple of sentries talking to one another and saying, oh, I had this terrible dream last night. I know what it's about too. It means that Gideon and his army are going to annihilate us. We're going to get slaughtered. And the guy says, yeah, so much for my old age pension too. And Gideon starts to realize that this fighting force that seems so fierce and so united against him actually isn't. And time and again, when we go into something for God that seems absolutely daunting and scary, we find the opposition doesn't really amount to a row of beans. Because what can seem big and impressive and awful against us just crumbles away when you look at some of the arguments that are being put out today against Christian faith. When you read some of the books of people like Dan Brown and Richard Dawkins and others, you can be scared because you think, well, some of these guys are professors. They're well-known novelists. They must know what they're talking about. And in the case of Dan Brown, he quotes names and figures and historical facts and all sorts of things. And then you start looking at it, and it all crumbles apart. And you think, that's it? That's all there is? I remember starting Derren Brown's book about his autobiography with a bit of foreboding, because I knew that he's a very clever boy. He's somebody who's very, very bright indeed. I also knew that in his teens, he was involved with the Christian church. He was a very keen Christian for a while. And I knew that also now he's rejected the whole thing totally. And so I wondered exactly what his reasons would be. And I read through the book until I came to the three pages where he dismisses Christianity pretty crisply and says it's a load of rubbish. And after I'd read those three pages, I thought, that's it? You gave it all up for that? I could answer that in about 3 minutes. That is completely ridiculous. Those are the best arguments you've got. And I couldn't believe that someone as intelligent, as thoughtful, and as knowledgeable and shrewd about human beings and the way they think as Derren Brown was, would accept half-baked, crummy arguments like that. But often that's the way it is, isn't it? The opposition isn't as strong as you think it's going to be. And I'm starting to preach a sermon here, which I shouldn't be, so let's move on. Chapter 3. Okay, this is a summary, not a total exposition of the book of Joshua. I will still be here at breakfast time. Chapter 3, then. Something else that God does for you, I think, when you start out in service for him, is that he tests your faith. Joshua, you've got to go through the river. I can't do that. I'll get wet. What's more than that? I'll get drowned. And everybody else will as well. That can't be done. It's just impossible. Joshua, just go to the edge of the river and walk into it. Oh, I suppose I could do that. But you've got to tell everybody else to do that as well. I can't do that. They'll laugh at me. It's crazy. And so Joshua has to stand up and say to people, now, folks, God is going to make this river open up in front of you. I'll bet he doesn't. And we're all going to walk through safely. I'll bet we won't. And you're going to see me as a great hero. I'm going to get egg all over my face. And he probably didn't believe any of it. But God did it. And when you obey in something small, God takes you into something big. Why was God doing a stunt like this? Simply because he knew if he could get Joshua to screw up his faith enough to get his feet wet, or risk getting them wet anyhow, he didn't actually get wet, then it was going to be less of a problem to him to march against a great city like Jericho. When you're faithful to God in the small things, then faithfulness in the big things isn't that difficult. And so these small tests of faith will come along just to help us see, am I really prepared to go through with this and trust God's power to get me through when I have no visible means of support, or am I just going to give in? God will test your faith, and he'll test it in small ways before you get to the really big trial. What about chapter 4? Well, I think there's a principle here as well. And that's a principle that God gives you markers. He gives you experiences of himself, of his faithfulness, of what he's done for you, that you can bear in mind in future. Do you remember that stone Ebenezer that was set up later in the Old Testament? Ebenezer means hitherto the Lord hath helped us. And we need these markers in our lives of times when we remember God's faithfulness, when we remember how God just miraculously brought everything together when we were really at our wit's end and didn't know what to do next. And so God makes sure they don't lose the experience. The trouble is, it's all too easy, isn't it, to forget what's happened, because life rushes on. And even when something brilliant happens to you, you may forget very quickly afterwards. Jesus cleanses 10 leopards. How many come back to say thank you? One. The others are so excited by what's happened to them, they even forget to say thank you to the person who's made it all possible. And they're so absorbed with the experience, it never actually strikes them, if this guy can do that for me, maybe he can do a lot more as well. And it's so easy, isn't it, to miss the impact of what happens to us because we just don't think about it. That's why God says to Joshua, get those stones out of the river, set them up where everybody can see and remember. There could be a visible sign to everybody for years to come, including those that didn't go through that experience, that I actually did something for you. Where are the markers in your life? What can you look back on where you've planted a stone to say, God did it for me. God's come through in a situation where I never expected him to do. God has taught me a real lesson here and here and here. We all need those markers, and we need to keep on revisiting them. And the fifth and final thing? Well, that's where you see in chapter 5 that when you started moving out for God, when he's given you a vision of what's to go on, when he's started to encourage you and yet to test your faith, and he's given you markers and your experience so far of what's got to happen, he'll deepen that faith by doing different things that will take you on further and further. In chapter 5, you find three things, don't you? You find circumcision for the first time in a generation. You find no manna. The manna suddenly stops, and the Israelites realize, from now on, folks, we eat the fruit of the land. We don't get the stuff that God's sending down from heaven. We've got to grow the crops and survive in that way. And the third thing that happens is this strange person appears on the plains of Jericho and says, I'm not on your side. I'm not on their side. I'm the commander of the host of the Lord. What's happening to Joshua and his people here? I think three things, and with this we're finished. First of all, the thing about circumcision talks about the challenge to be different. You see, that was to be the mark of the Israelites way back in the days when God made the covenant with them to start with. And in the desert, that had slipped, and the generation that never got to the promised land had lost it totally in all sorts of different ways. And one of the things that they'd stopped doing was observing their side of the bargain that they'd made with God. And circumcision, the ceremony that they were supposed to go through as soon as a male child was born, just wasn't happening any longer. Now God was calling them back to that. And he was saying, just how serious are you, you people? You signed an agreement with me. You made a covenant with God. I've been faithful to my side of it. Are you going to stay faithful to yours? And there'll be times in our life too, won't there, when we're challenged to reaffirm what we've promised, to go back, to rededicate ourselves, to say, Lord, things have slipped a little bit and I want to go right back and start again from where I once was. It's radical, it might hurt, but I'm going to do it. The challenge to be different. Then there's a challenge to trust more. You see, when you're getting manna delivered every day, you don't have too much of a difficulty working out what the menu's going to be, do you really? It's there for you, on the ground, every morning. You just have to go around with a jar and collect it. In fact, you can't store it up for the future, because one thing they found very quickly was if you try and do that, it goes off and it smells terrible. So you're reliant on God's daily hand-to-mouth supply. Now God has got them this far. And it's as if he's saying to them, I'm not going to nursemaid you any longer. You're going to have to trust me a little bit more. I will send the crops. I will sustain you. But it won't be a daily miracle any longer. What's going to happen now is that the natural processes of the year are going to be used by me to feed you. And you've got to look for me acting not just in the showy and the supernatural, but in the natural things that go on. And you've got to trust me year by year, rather than day by day, that I will not let you down. And it's a challenge to trust God more than they've had to up until now. And that'll happen as we grow as Christians, won't it? That God will put us out into bigger and bigger steps of faith. And he'll trust us in situations where we're not seeing him acting every 5 minutes or every morning when he sends the manna down. But we'll go longer periods without any evidence of his grace. Yet we will know that he's there, and the same provision will be there in the background as it always has been. Final thing, well, I guess this is a challenge to be humble. Joshua's working out his battle plan, thinking about what's going to happen when finally he faces the forces of Jericho. We could do this, but they will probably do that. And if we stand here, then they're going to go there. And if we send in the infantry, then they'll get their archers. And it's all us and them, me and him, myself, the king of Jericho. And he sees it as a two-way struggle. And suddenly, as he's thinking like this, he looks up and there's a man with a drawn sword in front of him. So his hand leaps straight to his holster. Are you for us or are you for them? And he's only thinking in terms of us and them. And the guy says, neither. You see, Joshua, you are seeing this battle in terms of two sides. Your side and the enemy side. There's a third side. I am the commander of the army of the Lord of hosts. And even if you are fighting this battle on a physical level, God is involved too. And you're not fighting it for yourself or by yourself. You're fighting it in the strength that he provides. And you're not just fighting it for your own benefit, but you're fighting it for his purposes. Ultimately, he's the boss, and you are just a servant of his, as I am. And so Joshua falls to his feet, down to his knees, realizing that something very strange is going on here that he doesn't have a chance of understanding. And that's the way it works, isn't it? Whatever we go into for God this autumn, whatever he calls us individually or in our family life or in our church life to do, he's going to be there. He's going to be the sustainer of everything. And it's only when we're humble, when we're different, when we're trusting him more and more as he leads us into further adventures, that we'll see the glory of what he can really do.